Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 168.
I remember watching Fellowship of the Ring for the first time in the theater. Having grown up reading and loving the books, finally seeing it on the big screen was a very surreal experience. At the end of the film, Frodo and Sam are gazing across the dead marshes into Mordor, where we are given a sense of foreboding as we can see the faint glow of Mount Doom over the mountain range. The movie ends, and the reactions of the moviegoers begin. I remember one person in the theater completely perplexed because they didn't know The Lord of the Rings was a trilogy. They would have to wait another 2 years to find the conclusion. Or they could have just read the books. In one sense, the book of Malachi gives us the same kind of pause. The prophet gives us several themes in regard to the narrative of Scripture. It tells us what the conditions of life were like for Israel after exile. It once again picks up the story of the coming of the Messiah, who will answer the promises that were made to Adam and then Abraham. It will help all of us, as we study the Gospels, to have the promises made in Malachi in mind and to remember that God will never forsake His people. In this next series, we will study this prophetic book and examine how God sets up the narrative for the coming of the Messiah. So who was Malachi? What were the issues that the Israelites faced right after exile? And how were these issues addressed? We will discuss these and other questions today on Theology Simply Profound.
Well, welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. I'm Bob Tirillo. I serve as pastor here at Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Indian Head Park in the western suburbs of Chicago. And with me, as always, is Rob McKenzie. Rob's an elder here at Westminster. He's also an MDiv student at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando. Hey, Rob.
Hi. It's really good to be here. I'm glad I made it.
Glad you made it.
Well, yeah.
Do you have trouble?
I did a little bit of trouble coming through your house because the beast apparently is very hungry and was trying to choose between its own food and your children. And so I had to tiptoe my way through, lest it saw me and decided to attack me.
We were wondering if it was going to be the kids or the kibble.
Kids or the kibble.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but thankfully she wasn't that hungry.
No, she did finally go for a kibble. I don't know. You didn't see the look in her eye like I saw. I mean, so you count your children every night. That's all I'm saying.
We make sure we have them all. We only have three, so it's not that difficult.
You got a couple spares. Yeah. Depending on the day, they can rotate who the spare is.
Oh, goodness. We're talking about the book of Malachi now, aren't we?
We are.
We've got a couple of spares. That's just awful. I don't even know how to begin or continue now.
I told you unsettled you now? Wow. That's all it took. Okay, I'll keep good to know.
You talk. Good you talk know. While I can know. Talk.
Yeah, no, we're going to talk about Malachi now. We're going to be silly. What I wanted to do with this series, the new series we're doing, is just kind of set the tone, you know, what is God doing before the incarnation, just before the incarnation? How does Christ, what kind of a community has Christ come into in the Jewish community? I think it's always good for us to know what the disciples and the Jewish community at the time of Christ is set in. Where have they come from? What are they? What are their traditions? What are they? You know, what's it like?
Yeah, and that kind of begins in Malachi, obviously through the intertestamental period, which is about 450 years or so after between Malachi and the Jesus day, 450, 500, depending on dating on Malachi, which we'll talk about in part. A lot changes between Malachi and there, because Malachi, we have a setting in Persia is actually in power.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, something changes. Persia stops being in power, and then Greece becomes the power mm-hmm. house. So, and then Rome. So right. just a bit of a change right. in political power. But it is good to see where the revelation of God ends, right?
Right.
And
right.
and that's what we get in Malachi, where that revelation ends before we get the new revelation that we have recorded for us in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And it is, I think, going through Malachi as we're going to and seeing how God sets up, so to speak, the coming of the Messiah, which is what he does, mm-hmm. in part in Malachi, will be interesting and fun for us.
Yeah, I think it's just in studying this again, mm-hmm. looking at this from this angle, I was surprised at how many times in the Old Testament it was said that Israel would end up in captivity. Mm-hmm. They would be there for 70 years, and they'd be returned. And it, from the very beginning,
yeah.
we see mm-hmm. that they're going to end up in this captivity as part of God's plan. And yet, of course, they're there in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of years, this is predicted 100 years before it actually happens. And we often look at them being taken into captivity for Babylon as severe judgment. How do we understand that in the sense that God is in control of all things?
Yeah.
He's sovereign. And he says, you're going to go into captivity. But then they are brought into captivity because of their own sin, their own failure. And so sometimes I think this is where, as Calvinists, we look at it as, well, God is sovereign,
yeah,
and he has determined this will happen. But then how can we blame them for going into captivity?
Well, I mean, that's an issue of human responsibility and God's sovereignty that people struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
The people of Israel are certainly still responsible for their own actions. God is not responsible for man's individual actions. We see this in the scriptures throughout. And so to put those two concepts in conflict with each other is to put the scriptures in conflict with each other. And we're not meant to do that. These two things are true. God is sovereign and man is responsible for his actions. And man stands trial and condemnation for his actions and receives blessing for not his actions, right? In Christ, right?
Right?
I mean, it's someone else's actions. So you have the consequence of their own unfaithfulness, Israel, let's just say that. I mean, so you have a divided kingdom for much of Israel's history, right after David, essentially. And so after that, you have a divided kingdom of Israel and Judah. Their unfaithfulness proves to show that Assyria takes out Israel. You know, the 10 tribes mm-hmm. are scattered, and then you have Judah that remains, and then eventually they are taken off, or much of them are taken off into Babylon. Babylon's taken over by Persia, and then Cyrus lets God's people go back. I mean, there's a summary of, you know, the Old Testament,
yeah.
and through that you have the Mosaic economy, the period of the law, and then you have the kingdom, and where the law continues, of course. And the Davidic kingdom and the promises given to him. You have the exile, where the people are in Babylon for 70 years as promised. And then you have a restoration. And that's because God has also promised not only that his people would be unfaithful, he knows this is going to happen, but also he knows that he is going to restore his people. His promises will remain faithful, and he will keep his promises. And we see that remnant, and you see that through sort of the especially throughout the minor prophets, as we call them, not because they're minor in importance, but because they're shorter in length by right. way of the writing, the written prophets or the written. So you have the three major writing prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And then you have the 12 minor writing prophets, and that's where we find Malachi. Excuse me, that's where we find Malachi. And Malachi happens to be the last of the prophetic writers that we have recorded for us, and chronologically seems to be the last as well. We don't seem to have anyone else writing chronologically. Now, right. in the Hebrew Bible, he's not last. They order things differently.
Right.
But in the English Bible, it comes to us where Malachi is the last, and that's very, I think, helpful for us to see that connection right. between Malachi and the new, because Matthew in particular.
Yeah, you're right. Well, Matthew, just the way that yeah. they the the way the Jewish people order their books.
Right.
He still is the last prophet.
Yes. Chronologically,
which is not in the setup of the books within the Torah.
And as I remember, I don't have a reference for this offhand, but I remember being taught that actually the Jewish people would actually reorder some of the words of Malachi, closing words of Malachi, because Malachi ends in judgment.
Yeah.
But they didn't like that.
Most people don't.
And so they moved things around in order to keep it from being the last words of God to them.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I always find that interesting.
You have to find out what the word, because I haven't heard that before.
Yeah,
so what's the word order? We'll find that
I'm
out.
I'm thinking this off the cuff right now, and so I don't have the reference. But
we
have
two more episodes on the.
I can try to find that.
Try to find that. Yeah, I think that's...
And if I'm completely wrong, just let me know.
That's a really... Well, I wouldn't... Yeah, I won't tell you that.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Not in this one, anyway. Yeah, I think that's a really good summary, but just go over a few things that you went by. You know, 722, you have the Assyrians coming in and taking away the northern kingdom, which, as you had said, Israel had been divided into two, north and south. The southern kingdom was basically Judah and Benjamin, and they were for the better part. They were the godly people. It's hard to say that since there's so much sin happening, but still, they still had godly kings.
You mean comparatively speaking?
Comparatively speaking, how's that? Because the northern kingdom never had a godly king. They, from the very beginning, set up false idols and false doctrines. They tried to integrate the worship of Yahweh into other pagan deities of the land, but also it was Jeroboam that decided to really change the religion. He didn't want people going to Jerusalem to worship, he set up false places that they can give sacrifices, not ordained by God.
Yeah, of course. And you reference Jeroboam, and as you go through the kings, you always see Jeroboam. This king sinned like Jeroboam, and it's always brings you back to Jeroboam, and you're referring to his setting up the altars at Bethel and Dan, and Bethel is the far south of the northern kingdom of Israel, and it's kind of like on the way to Jerusalem, so it's meant to like, hey, you don't need to go any further, you can stop here and get all you need, and then you have the mixture of the pagan deities with Yahweh, so it's never actually meant to change. It's kind of like. The way that Aaron said to, look, behold your God. Yeah. And in fact, it's a doubling of Aaron's sin, Jeroboam, because it's two cows, right? It's not just one. The way that Aaron makes one golden calf, and Jeroboam makes two, Bethel and Dan. Mm-hmm. And Dan is at the farthest northern parts of the region of the northern kingdom. And so you have these two places that people can go and find their fulfillment of doing their religious duties. Mm-hmm. and that God didn't like that.
No. You just, one thing that we find out is that godly people, godly priests actually left the northern kingdom and went to the southern kingdom when this happened, because they wanted to fulfill their duty to God, to Yahweh, and actually worship at the temple and partake of the true religion. So the northern kingdom, when Assyria comes in and takes them, it had already been, this is now, 150, 200 years after the split. And the people there had been decimated religiously. They no longer had, at least the southern kingdom had the temple. They still had many of the godly priests. They still had the law there. Now we know that it wasn't practiced all the best, but still it was there. And in the northern kingdom, you just didn't have that. So by the time they're taken away, and what Assyria would do is they would decimate a land and take all the people and assimilate them into other places. So you had the people from other nations being brought and placed into the northern territory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now you had pagans that have come in, not even trying to worship Yahweh, bringing their own gods in. And the interesting thing about that is that God starts to judge them because they're not worshiping him.
Yeah.
Because this was where you worship Yahweh. And
they eventually become the Samaritans.
They become the Samaritans because they had to bring in, Assyria actually had to bring in some Israelites to show them, how do we worship the God of this land? Because we're being judged. And that's right, exactly what you're saying. So there's an intermixing of the races of Jew and Gentile, and you have the Samaritans. Mm-hmm. So in Israel, or in Judah, there's still the continuation of the what was supposed to be the following of the worship of Yahweh and the following of the law of Moses.
Yeah.
But by the time we get to Jeremiah and even Isaiah and just all these the prophets that we're talking about, we're the southern kingdom, Judah, is told repeatedly, actually, you have sinned greater than your sister Israel. So even though they were allowed to remain in the land, that now it's 586, so now it's 150 years later-ish, and God's coming to them saying, you have sinned. You should have seen what happened to Israel or what happened to the northern kingdom as a warning.
Yeah.
And yet, here you are sinning even worse. Mm-hmm. And of course, the reason why God brings in Babylon to take away the people of the southern kingdom in judgment, but it's only going to be in temporary judgment, is because God has made these promises, first to Adam and then to Abraham, that he's going to fulfill his covenant, and he's going to do that through the people of Israel. And so, although the northern kingdom got taken away and never to be returned again, mm-hmm. the southern kingdom, God, in order to be faithful to his own promises, has to bring them back. Even though Jeremiah tells them, or God is telling them through Jeremiah, I've divorced you.
Yeah.
Because of your spiritual adultery, I've divorced you. But yet the people are still brought back. And so they're coming back as out of exile and still as the people of God, but it's almost as if they're still under the curses.
Well, in a certainty, this is where we get confused a lot, because we think a lot in individual terms.
Yeah.
And Israel is being dealt with as though Israel as a whole is an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all of Israel is being brought back as a nation and a people of God. It doesn't speak to individual salvation, right? Because there mm-hmm. are, you know, what we might say is Old Testament believers
yeah.
who are in here and who were sent in exile,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think it's helpful for us to get that, because when Israel is exiled, it's a judgment, a curse upon the whole of the nation. But yet you have people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego,
right
who are there, who are faithful. And so they suffer the consequences of the curse by being pulled out of the land, even though they remain themselves personally and individually saved, we might say. Mm-hmm. It's not in the same exact terminology that we would use now, but they're faithful to the covenant as God's been. They're still sinners, of course, they're repentant, but they're faithful to the covenant.
Well, that's the remnant,
yeah.
The remnant you were talking about.
Yeah. And then they go back, and so it's still a mixed bag that goes back to right. Israel. You have, you know, unbelief and belief among the people. But God will care for them depending on the, I don't know if it's a majority. You know, he bears with his people for a certain period of time before, you know, essentially bringing the hammer and bringing the judgment mm-hmm. with the exile. And then after 70 years, as he promised, he brings them back and sets them up for something to come.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you talked about this majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't exactly how
right.
That works.
No, we don't. But that's, you know, there are people that remain. You know, like you were talking about Persia, it mm-hmm. takes over at this time. Persia's allows them through Nehemiah and Ezra. Mm-hmm. That's when they're coming back. But a lot of people actually didn't return. They stayed.
They made a life.
And so their children were staying there. And this mm-hmm. is kind of when and it depends on what document you're looking at. When a synagogue system starts to develop, mm-hmm. Now that's going to become stronger as years go on, and definitely once Greece comes in and defeats Medo-Persia, that the synagogue, once Greece kind of rules the land, the synagogues start to become much more prominent. And so you start, even though the people are brought back, there's still an expansion of Israelites throughout the empire, the Grecian empire, mm-hmm. and then of course Rome. And so Jerusalem, which had been the the center of Jewish worship, of Jewish life, Everything revolved around the temple. Everything was pointed at Jerusalem. By the time Christ comes, Jerusalem in and of itself is not the, well, of course, in the world, it's not the center. But even for the Jewish people, there's so many scattered throughout Rome.
Not
there's
as
so
it was, scattered. Right.
Right. It's become, they'll still make their pilgrimage.
Herod the Great tries, right, because he rebuilds the temple.
Right.
Certainly not to the extent of Solomon. But so after Solomon's temple is destroyed, that's about the time, and it's hard to say exactly like you said, of the synagogue system beginning, right, because of the... Because of the deportation to Babylon, and they needed something. They needed to do something, right?
And
so they develop a some form of system to be able to read the scriptures and hold on to the law and the prophets and the writings as what they had at that time. And so the timing is not exactly known. Like you said, it's around that time. But what's interesting is it comes back, you know, with them into. Israel, I think, with them into the land, and even when they're being told to build the temple during the return and the restoration, as we call it, you know, they don't go right at it. They don't get right at that building process, as which is, you know, much of what the writers of the minor prophets in the exilic period are after. You know, like, why aren't you doing what I asked you to do?
Yeah, and of course it takes Nehemiah to come in and lead the people. So they finally, they should have already been building. When he comes in, they could have been rebuilding the wall then. They allowed it to remain. They were scared because there were people in the area that did not want that wall rebuilt, and they were afraid of them.
Right.
So Nehemiah comes in and motivates the people, leads the people. It really gives you a great understanding of what leaders can do. Because he comes in, and because of his brilliant leadership and the way he handles opposition, the way that he motivates the people where they're building at, where they live, they're building at that area, the wall gets rebuilt very quickly. Only within a few months, you have the wall built. I think they still had yet to hang the gates, but still the wall itself is built. Mm-hmm. And Ezra, you know, is there... With spiritual reforms, and the temple was being repaired, and there were corrupt governors that were in Jerusalem as well. And when Nehemiah is made governor, he becomes a godly governor and actually helps the people and cares about the people. Even though, if you look at all like what his meals are at night, now there's a lot of people that are eating with him. But you're still looking at that going, man, that's a lot. That seems like a lot. But he had reduced it from what had been taken by the governors before him.
Yeah, I was just, as you were talking there, did a quick search on Cyrus because I was trying to remember exactly what his decree was in sending the people back. Because I couldn't remember offhand if it included the building of the temple itself. And it certainly does.
Okay.
Right. And 2 Chronicles 36, 22, and 23, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. And that decree is referenced also in Ezra 1, 1 and 2, Ezra 1, 7, 8, Ezra 3, Ezra 4, 5. I mean, it is throughout that this is what their very purpose in being sent back was because the Lord gave Cyrus a charge to build him a house in Jerusalem. And this Persian king answers that call and say, hey, you, his people, go do it.
Yeah.
And then the people fail.
Yeah.
It's always fun seeing in the scriptures, the Gentiles doing what the Jews couldn't do or wouldn't do.
Right.
To me, it always speaks to the eventual, inclusion open inclusion of the Gentiles into the covenant as a whole. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've heard people debate, you know, well, is Cyrus a believer?
Oh, yeah, well, I'm not that. Speaking of that, yeah.
I know, but it's funny because the point is, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. God is in control of all things, and there's nothing that any nation can do that God does not allow. And so even if he was, you know, we think about it, if he's a pagan, if he's not a believer in any way, and yet he is still under the direct sovereign control of the king of the universe. And so God will get his desires done no matter whom is helping achieve.
Yeah. Them. Yeah. I mean, and even in Isaiah 44, the prophet tells us that that God says he is my shepherd, referring to Cyrus, and he shall fulfill my purpose. She shall be built, meaning saying of Jerusalem and of the temple, your foundation shall be laid. I mean, this was Cyrus's purpose. Was he was charged by God to have Israel, the people, the remnant going back to build this temple. And that's so then when you have the people not doing this, and there are of course lots of difficulties and so on and so forth, but you know, the life of the people of God are always fraught with difficulties. Mm-hmm. But they're still not obeying his primary purpose of sending them back was to give that house, to rebuild that house of God in some form or fashion. But what we have now in Malachi, just to try to bring this full circle, the house is built.
Yes.
The house is built.
The house is built.
And so it's a slightly different context now, though.
Right. Right. But these are the same people that saw that saw that rebuilding of the temple, mm-hmm. that saw that rebuilding of the wall, mm-hmm. Or at least their parents were the one, you know.
Yeah, depending on timing.
It also depends on how old they were. Mm-hmm. But some of them, there's got to be a mix.
Right, at the time when they moved back, yeah.
There would have been people there who had been in exile and would have understood that, and now they're back. And one thing that Nehemiah had to deal with was the fact that starting with the priests, but also the people, had married people that they were not supposed to marry. And Nehemiah, I mean, you know, remember, great, great leader, but he looks at them and he says, you have to divorce your non-Jewish spouses. You have to separate from them. And the people do, or at least we're told the people do. This is one thing that we're told in Nehemiah that they do. And it was very hard. Think about that. You marry somebody and you actually like them, and you now have to, because God is telling you to, you have to divorce them. And these were, why do you think that's going on? Or why do you think that God was so hardline of that, or Nehemiah? Maybe Nehemiah was speaking for himself and not speaking for God.
Well, it's certainly not an easy question to answer with any, at least for us at the moment, with any great detail. But I would think, especially offhand, that what we see, and it's not just in Nehemiah, it's Ezra as well. You have, and I think see it here, especially in Ezra 10, this intermarrying that God is telling through Ezra, he's telling that this is not right. And that's because there's this sense, and we know from earlier revelation that Israel's meant to be pure. She's not meant to intermarry to people outside of the covenant community. And when when they're in Persia, when they're in Babylon, rather, which becomes Persia, had intermarried.
Powerhouse.
Yeah, thank you. Had intermarried. And so when they go back to the land to continue the line of purity or the covenant line, there is this, you know, essentially, you know, these marriages are null and void because they weren't according to God's law.
Right. Now, at least that's what it seems.
That's what
it
appears
seems like
to
that's
be.
What's
yeah.
going on. Yeah.
The end of Ezra refers to that there are children born of this. So this is not an easy thing. So there are mixed children that came out of this. And he calls the marriages abominations and such because it's not according to God's law. So what happens to those people, to the women, the foreign wives? I don't know.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know.
And we're not speaking to what that would do to those women or anything like that. Right. But the point was going back to the that time that the covenant people of God were meant to restart, so to speak, and restart the theocratic kingdom in the sense of we're going back, we're starting Israel all over again, right? And we need to reestablish the laws that God has put before us. We need to have a pure Jewish society, and that was one of the ways that he used to do that.
Right. I mean, from the very beginning, Israel was created to be the people that was set apart.
Yeah, different from all the foreigners.
How they dressed, how they ate, how they lived, and God was very specific in how they were to live, and part of that was not marrying people outside the community because they were supposed to be the visible representation of the people of God to the nations. And so there was a purity that they were supposed to maintain. Mm-hmm. And so now coming back out of captivity, after they were given curses, they broke the covenant, they received the curses of the covenant, but God in his mercy brings them back. Because God has promised first to Adam and Eve, saying, the seed of the woman will crush the head of the seed of the serpent. Mm-hmm. So that has to happen. And he's promised through Abraham that through him, that would be fulfilled. That the Messiah would come through him. That through him, the nations of the earth will be blessed. And we know that through the Abrahamic covenant, that is going to come the Messiah.
Right.
And that is still needs to be put into play, even though the nation failed. They were under the old covenant, and they had failed. They had broken it, received the curses, but they were still, as the people of God, whom God had called out, were still under the old covenant. And they still were supposed to be the visible representation of the people of God. They were still supposed to adhere to the covenant made by God through Moses.
Like a theocracy.
And that's how they were supposed to function, which is part of the reason why today it always makes my eyebrow go up when I hear people looking back at very specific commands that were given to Israel to be Israel, and they try to make them applicable to nations today.
Yeah, that's no good.
You can't do that.
No,
this was specifically for them. And
a specific nation and a specific time being used by God for a specific purpose.
Right, and now the new covenant has come.
Yeah.
And the new covenant is not like the old covenant. It is new. And it has, we function differently as the people of God. So the fact that, but well, I guess what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to set up the culture of the nation as Malachi himself is going to be ministering to. Mm-hmm. This is what had happened with Nehemiah coming out. Of course, Esther had been at this time, just before Malachi.
During this time, yeah.
And this is how the people were situated as far as their culture. There had been foreign wives, there had been intermarriage, and that had been condemned. Exactly how that outworked, we're not given great detail.
Right.
But we know that the people had been judged for intermarrying. And now Malachi comes along, and he comes to the same culture, and he's going to have to deal with some of these same problems.
Yeah, he certainly does. And in dealing with that, Malachi comes as a prophet to speak to specific sins now that these people are dealing with. And what's interesting is that while there's a lot of continuity, there's some differences now because the temple is built, and you have the people who are married, divorcing their wives, and God is not happy about that. Mm-hmm. You have them being very
well in Malachi's context.
Yes, it's a different context.
They're divorcing their Jewish wives to marry foreign wives.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, I should have been clear on that one, especially given the previous conversation. but because the temple's built and they've been living there for a little while, there a sense of malaise has come over the people. A sense of this is the language that I've been reading from various commentators and authors is disillusionment, malaise, complacency, forgetfulness. Because now you're in a, you know, well, okay, we did what you asked, it's done. Yeah. What's up, God?
Yeah.
We're still under Persian rule, or now, yeah. not yet, but another ruler will come in, and then another ruler will come in, and so this gets to where you actually started. You know, that sense of when will the rulers go away, other than us, right. and us being the center of the universe again? Mm-hmm. And that's not happening, and you get a sense of disgruntledness, discontentment. Mm-hmm. And a sense of, you know, spiritual malaise, mm-hmm. and they stop caring for the things that God wants them to care for. So when they do bring their stuff to the temple, hey, yay, they're bringing their sacrifices. They're bringing mm-hmm. really awful stuff. They're not bringing the best. They're bringing torn up pieces of meat. They're not yeah. bringing the perfect stuff that God has asked for them. They're not tithing. They're not giving the way that mm-hmm. God has asked them to give, which, if they did, it would be reflective of their heart, but they're not, which is reflective of their heart, yes. which is a heart that doesn't care about God. It's a heart that says, I don't love you. And that's what he is addressing yeah. in Malachi.
Well, I think the part of the reason why marriage is so important is because God is using marriage as a metaphor to talk about his relationship with his people. And so when you stop obeying God's commands in who you are to marry and how that is supposed to look within the community, you're messing up the metaphor. And so now we get to the New Testament, and it's, what does God say? That we are the bride of Christ. And we are God, you know, pays the bridal price for us. And when you, if you go back and you see the visible people of God who are supposed mm-hmm. to be representing who God is and what he's going to do, and they're marrying foreign wives, it doesn't translate. That doesn't yeah. reflect on who God is and what he's actually doing. So God is looking at them saying, you're sinning against me because you're not being obedient. And like you're saying, they're lethargic about it. They're saying, well, look, we finally got out of captivity. We're actually still under the Persian rule. This is all we're getting? This
yeah, is what life's like. It's very much like, and very much like that. And this is Malachi's point, is really calling the people to repentance, and he does it in a very interesting way. We'll see as we go through this with
a rhetorical question comes up.
Yeah, yeah. They're usually called the sort of disputes, and it's a God saying through the prophet, saying, you know, you've done this, and then there's a question that's implied from the people. Well, mm-hmm. how have we done this? And then yeah. he's like, well, you did it like this, yeah. you know, and they're like, what, really, us? No, you know, and he's really goes after that, and he there's, this is being more general, that there's some really interesting ways in which he does this, and it's been captured by, in popular culture for us, in the Messiah that we listen to, that language of that Handel has in the singing, and it goes right up to this judgment that's coming, and then that moves in wonderfully, beautifully into the coming of Christ that eases the judgment. There's just this wonderful, wonderful play that has happened, and you see that in Malachi itself, in the way in which God gives us three messengers, really, in Malachi. We have the prophet himself, Malachi, which means my messenger, of course. Then there's another one named or called my messenger will come. Mm-hmm. And then he refers to this one as Elijah. And we know from the New Testament that to be John the Baptist. And then he refers to the messenger of my covenant. Mm-hmm. And that we know will be Jesus the Christ, right? And the Messiah himself. And so it's like, I'm giving you a messenger. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's going to warn you. Oh, you're not going to listen to him. Okay. I'm going to give you another messenger, mm-hmm. all about repentance. And oh, you're not going to listen to him. I'm going to give you the messenger, yeah. right? Because he says, so this is all in chapter 3, verse 1, actually. And then 4-5, it tells us it's John the Baptist. That's Elijah. But in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, my messenger will come, and he identifies him as the Lord mm-hmm. himself. Mm-hmm. So you get there the sense and that wonderful play together where throughout the Old Testament, there's this, who's going to come? Is it going to be the king? Is it going to be a prophet? Who's going to be the Messiah? And you slowly come to understand as you're reading through the Old Testament, it can't be any of these. These are all imperfect. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be God himself, right? You get a hint of that in Genesis 15 when God goes through the pieces of the covenant, and he says, you know, it's a self-maledictory oath that he makes, and he takes it upon himself on the cross. Mm-hmm. And so here, you know, it has to be God himself who comes, and he does so in the person of Jesus Christ to bring resolution to everything that we're dealing with here in Malachi especially, but more generally, everything that has to do with the Old Testament.
Yeah, the people that have now come through the exile, that have seen the rebuilding of the wall, the rebuilding of the temple, that have seen a moral reform within the society, they're, like you were saying, the malaise, the lethargy, the "is this it" kind of attitude that they mm-hmm. have. And here comes this prophet that is saying, "Don't you understand? Now is the time that you are being reunited together so that God himself will bring about the Messiah.
Yeah.
All that has been promised will finally come. You shouldn't be lethargic about this. You should be, finally, we're here. Finally, we're at the place that the next thing that's going to happen is this messenger is going to come. This Messiah is going to come." They were told, Israel all the way at the beginning was told that you're going to be a nation. You're going to break my law. You're going to mm-hmm. go into captivity. You're going to come out of captivity. Now they're at the place of coming out of captivity. And so there should be this joy, this rejuvenated people of God that are now saying, great, we're at this place where we're going to obey your law and we're going to be obedient to you, because next we know that Messiah is coming. Next we know the messenger is coming. And yet what are they doing? They're getting rid of the wives they should have for foreign wives. They're bringing they're not caring about their offerings enough to bring what God has commanded. They're bringing their mm-hmm. leftovers. They're not tithing like they're supposed to tithe. They're not caring for the poor. They're just caring about themselves.
Yeah.
And that's why this prophet comes.
That's absolutely true. And I think as we make our way through Malachi together, we'll see that more clearly in the specific verses that we're dealing with. Of course, this is just an overview of the main message that we think this book brings for us or brings to us, because, you know, we're not living under that era anymore.
Right.
So how do we, as, you know, Bible-believing Christians, you know, which means Old and New Testament, we love the Word as a whole. So how does this book generate any kind of response from us? Is it only a response of, oh, look how bad the Jews were, or, you know, the returning exiles, and, you know, look, you know, down upon them? Is it meant to say, oh, look how forgetful we can be? We've had a few promises given to us. We've had a few hard times in our lives. How often, though, do we forget the coming of the Lord, that he is at hand, that our God is faithful, that his promises are yes and amen, that he will never leave nor forsake us? How often do we find ourselves just like these people in a malaise, disillusioned, discouraged, not encouraged by the good promises that God has given to us? Now, completely different redemptive historical epochs that we're in, mm-hmm. of course, but these things were given to us for our purposes, and for not our purposes, but for us, and for us to receive blessing from in our Christian walk, as an example, as testimony, as witness to God's goodness and kindness. And I think as Bible-believing Christians, we need to keep that in mind as we make our way through the Old Testament, and for us now, of course, Malachi.
Yeah. So one thing we because this is the introduction to it, is Malachi a real person?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We're done? No, you're right. So Malachi is sometimes, it's debated, but not so much in evangelical circles anymore. It's mm-hmm. debated whether or not Malachi is just generally my messenger, in the sense of an anonymous writer, identified with the "my messenger" that comes later in 3:1. But that "my messenger" is definitely related to Elijah. So it doesn't make sense to not be a specific person and a name. And so, and because most of the, or all of the other minor prophets have identities and names, it's understood that Malachi is not just a angel or angelic figure or something like that, but that he is a person. And there's a lot of other debates in critical theory about who it is. Some say it's Zechariah, actually, and that can be a conservative view as well. But I think generally the easiest way to understand it is it's and the simplest way to understand it is that it's Malachi.
Right. It doesn't really change the meaning of the book.
No, it certainly doesn't.
I think that I think the strongest evidence is that it is an actual person.
Yeah.
The prophets seem to identify themselves in all the prophetic books.
Yeah.
Who they are, and so. But I think the question needs to be asked.
And it's not it's not like we know anything else about him either.
Right.
There is no place of his birth. There's no, you know, who he is the son of or anything like that, which you do get in other books.
Right.
So that's why I think it remains a you know, mildly debated issue that, that really doesn't impact the reading of the book itself.
Mm-hmm. What about the year? When was this?
The year, well, we've already alluded to this. I think early 5th century is what we're talking here. Some say late 5th century. So I was reading, you know, so early 5th century is in the 540s, 520s BC. And that puts us right after Nehemiah and his reforms. Some put it in the middle of Nehemiah's reforms. And some,
you say 520s or is it 420s?
I'm sorry, 420s. Yeah, I said 5th century and the 5th carried over.
It's hard when you have to go backwards like that.
Yeah, it always is, right? So that puts it right around Nehemiah's reforms, either
seems like just after the reforms,
in the middle or before are the ones I've seen as
it's
potential.
Right. I don't think it makes much sense to have it before.
I hear you.
During I could see, but I do think it's after.
The during people Malachi says that there's a pagan governor. Or a Persian governor, sorry, present in town, and there's a time when Nehemiah leaves and goes to Susa. So some say it might be during that period.
Right, but can actually consider Nehemiah himself a Persian governor.
Most don't, but
but he's there because at the bequest of the Persian
government,
king.
Right?
So,
yeah,
you can title him like that. I agree that it probably is when Nehemiah had gone back, and that there's someone else there.
Right, right.
A little bit later.
But because the temple is complete, I think, and it seems like they're in a period of malaise already, that some time has gone by since the temple was complete. If I remember correctly, that was around 515 BC.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you need a little bit of time for that malaise to kick in.
Right.
So that disillusionment. I mean, it's not that much time.
It's not. Yeah, I think that the end of Nehemiah's ministry would, you know, late 400s, and depending on again who you're going to read. But you're right. There was this excitement when the wall and the temple was rebuilt. There's this great revival. Well, of course, why wouldn't there be? But we see that, and then like you're saying,
it's like a sugar high.
It's almost like this is, you know, what happens. The kids that were kids at this time grow up, and now they're expecting more.
And in their minds, nothing has happened. God has been unfaithful.
Right.
And like I said, that's why I said it was just like a sugar high. You get really high about the things that are happening, and you forget this is not about the immediate. God's plans are not our plans. His time frame is not our time frame, especially as puny humans. His time frame, if we look back over the course of Revelation, is long.
Yes.
And we need to keep that in mind so that we don't become so impatient as we so often do.
Right. And I think even in our own personal lives.
This is self-condemnatory here.
We also see, like we think, oh man, I've got to do something in 3 months. And we think, that seems like a long time.
Yeah.
But then we think about something that happened 15 years ago, and it's like, man, it was like yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. Kids grew up fast, right?
Yeah, you know? that's true. We grew up fast. Yeah.
And, speak for yourself.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sitting here with Benjamin Button.
I'm growing young. Yes, growing. Here I am. My body does not feel that way.
I think part of the importance of why all this setting is important is because this is going to lead us. How do we get from the return of exile to the mentality of the people that Jesus Himself has to deal with? And this is the beginning. This is the beginning of it. But this post-exilic Jewish people, and they're going to come now 500 years or 400 years later. What are they going to be thinking? How have they been living? What's happening? Well, now they're scattered. Now Jerusalem has lost its luster. It's no longer, even in Rome, they consider it this backwater of the Roman Empire. Nobody wants to go there to govern. It's the, you drew the short straw if you have to go there. And although Jewish, very devout Jewish people come on the Day of Atonement, they come to worship at the temple, they come to give their sacrifices. You also have a whole sect of Judaism in the Sadducees that deny the resurrection. They deny mm-hmm. how much they're the liberals of the group.
Exactly.
And, you know, what have the conservatives done? Well, they've added so many laws to the law of Moses that, you know, you can't even, you know, walk 10 steps on the Sabbath or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And a formalism and a hypocrisy, right. Of course.
So we see, but this is
heart
where,
divorced from.
This is where it's coming from. It's coming from mm-hmm. this post-exilic period where these people that have been returned, how are they going to be, what is their life in Israel that is going to bring them to that place? I think that's very important.
Well, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. We are a podcast of the Reformed Forum. And just keep you abreast of things going on, we don't want to forget about the upcoming Reform Forum Conference in the first weekend, the second weekend of October. And check out reformforum.org/conference to find out more about that conference and the topics that we'll be dealing with on the Spirit and the Law. And that will prove to be a wonderful, good time of fellowship if you are able to make it. Also, we are a listener-supported podcast, and so go to reformforum.org/donate to find out how you can do that. Also, I do want to, with regard to the Malachi study that we're doing, I do want to make one book recommendation. And this book is by someone actually I know, Anthony Salvaggio. He's a pastor within the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America. He wrote a book called The Prophets Speak of Him, Encountering Jesus and the Minor Prophets. And so we're obviously just one portion of this deals with Malachi, but if you've ever been one of those people that have a hard time with the minor prophets or prophets in general, this is actually a really, really helpful and enjoyable book to get a lot out of the minor prophets and to get a sense of the flow of them as a whole and to really read them Christologically. And to see how they point forward to Christ and how it really includes the Christian within their message. And so, again, The Prophets Speak of Him by Anthony Salvaggio. And this is Emmaus. What's that? Evangelical Press?
Evangelical Press by Emmaus.
So I've really enjoyed this book and found it helpful. And I'll be using this throughout probably our study at various points to have a quote here or there from a fellow I knew many years ago now, Anthony Salvaggio. Rob, what's up next time?
Well, next time we'll get into the beginning of the book and we'll talk about why people need to be told 5,000 times to do something.
All right. Well, again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.